Morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to welcome everyone to Kol Yom Rishon. Specifically, like to welcome my distinguished colleague, Rabbi Avraham Steinberg from the Young Israel, the main line, who's here this morning. And, of course, our noted speaker, who will be formally introduced in a moment. I will only say that Rabbi Dr. Kannefogel is in a rarefied atmosphere, having already had distinguished careers in Chinuch Rabbonis and academia. It's very rare to find someone who has managed to achieve all of those things in one lifetime. I want to thank all of the people who are involved in putting this program together, and within our shul specifically, I'd like to thank our executive director, Gwen Horowitz, and Rabbi Yehuda Seif for their efforts, and I'd like to ask Rabbi Seif to come forward to introduce the one who will do the introducing.
I don't want to take a lot of time. Just again, I want to thank all of our co-sponsors, the Kohel Yeshiva High School, Torah Academy, the Kohel Foundation, the Jewish Federation, Laura Marion Synagogue, and of course, for this one, the Katz Center of Advanced Judaic Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And just a note that our next Kol Yom Rishon will be on April 3rd. It's going to be Rabbi Willig, who is going to speak on two days after Judah Trudler's birthday. And he's going to speak on a Pesach-related topic. Dr. Yechiel Shor, who is what's your official title at the center? He'll tell you what his official title at the Katz Center is. He'll officially introduce Rabbi Kannefogel. Thank you, Yechiel.
Yeah, so thank you, everyone. I'm Yechiel Shor, the Klatt Family Director for Public Programs at the Katz Center, or just the Director for Public Programs. Thank you all for coming, and again, I join Rabbi Schmidman in thanking the hosting synagogue, and of course, Rabbi Seif and Rabbi Schmidman himself, and the Executive Director, Gwen, for all their help with this program. Now, I just want to say a few things about the center, really briefly. For those of you who do not know, originally the place was the Annenberg Research Institute, but in 1993 the place merged with Penn, and since then been this greenhouse for scholars in Jewish studies researching a variety of topics. The location itself is quite exciting, all the way down in Old City. And really, year after year, having this wonderful group of scholars from all over the world, not just from Israel or from North America, but also from Europe, from Germany, places like Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, France. So really, kind of like Jewish studies not just happening in the obvious places like the States and Israel, but also in Europe. And just to say one, really kind of like trying to one particularly special place about thing about the center is really it's trying to foster collaboration among people in the humanities, which is a big chidush. I mean, we kind of people here in the sciences, especially natural science, know that it's natural to collaborate. But in the humanities, you know, scholars have their own books and articles, and they produce scholarship, and it's something we really try and work hard on forming these dialogues among the scholars. And this brings me to talking about Professor Kannefogel, who's actually what we call a repeating fellow, because he's been with us back in 2003-2004 on historical and anthropological perspectives on Judaism, and now he's with us on researching the topic of conversion. And we, you know, obviously we love the fact that Professor Kannefogel is coming back to us, show something about how much he likes Philadelphia, but as far as we're concerned, we really wanted someone like Professor Kannefogel to anchor the discussions. These are the discussions about conversion, so to anchor those discussions with someone with such an authority on medieval commentaries, so this is certainly a mutual deal here. Professor Kannefogel is the Billy Ivy Professor of Jewish History at Yeshiva University, where he teaches at the Bernard Ravel Graduate School of Jewish Studies. His fields of expertise are medieval Jewish intellectual history and rabbinic literature. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Professor Kannefogel for his talk on Did Esther Convert in the Palace of Ahasuerus, Conversion and Jewish Identity in History and Halacha.
Thank you very much, Yechiel. Thank you, Yehuda. Thank you, Rabbi Schmidman. I very, very, very glad to be here. In addition to having a little bit to do with chinuch and rabbonis and academia, my fourth career, which I pursue very assiduously, is that I am a very, very devoted rail fan. I have both Iyun and Bekiyus, and if you want to ask me later on the way back out to the train, I can sort of tell you what I know. And this is a vocation. It's an avocation, which I don't know. My children thought it should be a vocation, but in any case, so one of the great things about being at the center and coming back here, the record will show that in addition to the second stint as a full fellow, in 1996 I was an adjunct fellow, so I already learned how to come to Philly on the train, and it's a great thing. And this is the third time, Baruch Hashem, that I am here. I think the first under Rabbi Schmidman's tenure, but it's the third, so it's a third and a third. So, and I'm doing it to give shiurim and, of course, to teach Torah, and also because I like riding on the train. In any case, it is wonderful to be here, and I want to thank everyone for their efforts. The Rabbonim, Rabbi Schmidman, also want to say Shalom Aleichem to Rabbi Steinberg, the people from the shul who worked so hard, led by Yehuda Seif, and of course Yechiel in the center, for bringing me here. And the center is just as exciting and as wonderful as Yechiel indicates, and I think that if you have any interest in academic scholarship, you have interest in these kinds of Jewish studies issues, it's a place to go to, it's a place to visit. They let people in, and there are all kinds of lectures, and I think it's something that you would all, if that's what your interest is, you would enjoy it very, very much. For today, since I am here on the train and going back on the train, I don't come with one shiur, I come with two. I'll only give you one, but I'll let you know about a second. Your sheets have actually two shiurim for Purim. Our topic for today, which as Yechiel noted, really relates to the issue of conversion and Jewish identity in history and halacha, and we'll see where Esther and Purim fits into that discussion. That's going to be our main discussion today. On the flip side, you have, I'll tell you honestly, you have last week's Kolel Yom Rishon at Yeshiva. I had the opportunity to talk about Afhein Hayu Boso Hanei, so we might even get into that a little bit, women's role in Purim and so on. So we'll try to even make a little bit of a wave at the second topic at the end if we have time. We can take questions, but these are yours to keep. So much more than I will say here, you have before you. And in fact, I will say, if you don't like anything that I say here, look at the Mar Makomos. They're excellent. I had something to do with some of them, but they speak for themselves, and I'm sure everybody will have something to learn. So let's talk about the title, Did Esther Convert in the Palace of Ahasuerus? The short answer is no. There are, however, that's a title to bring the people in, there are, however, amongst modern Bible scholars, those who claimed yes, not going to go through their scholarship, but we'll just make the point, the reason that that suggestion was made is really based on both a concept and a couple of psukim, twice in Perek Beis of the Megillah. We have statements that lo higida Esther es amav es molad ta, ein Esther maged es amav es molad ta. The Megillah stresses that Esther said nothing about her religion, and there are scholars who assert that given the enmity that Jews had, or the enmity towards Jews in the Malchus Ahasuerus, even though they were part of the Malchus, it's impossible to imagine that Esther could have ascended to the queenship without some type of conversion and some type of a formal process, and even if it was just a kind of a lip service thing, because otherwise she would have been really a queen from the other side. And we'll actually see a Mefarish who says something lahavdil like that in a different direction in a moment. So that's how the thinking goes. Of course, this also relates to the very difficult question or questions that Chazal raise in terms of Esther's observance. We understand very well, even though there is an opinion that Esther remained the niece of Mordechai, but of course we know very well that Chazal have to deal with the challenge of Esther being the wife of Ahasuerus, and so the question really is how that works. We have some understanding of, although of course Tosfos and others discuss at great length, Esther Karka Olam Haisa, was it Erevah, was it Arayos, was it permissible privately, and so on and so forth. These are very, very thorny questions. Question really is, what other areas of halacha were or were not observed? And again, the approach of some modern scholars is to say nothing was observed. We'll see, based on the Makaris that I will show you in a moment, that of course our Mefarshim don't think that way, and even somebody like the Ibn Ezra, who is no shrinking violet when it comes to sort of interpreting differently than Chazal in certain areas, we'll see what he does with Esther's sort of hidden religion. The other people who thought or who think that Esther might have made some type of formal conversionary move, Esther was a heroine, a real leading figure in the eyes of the Maranos, and you can imagine why. Right, those who were forced, or some of whom willingly converted to Judaism, to Christianity in in Spain, beginning in 1391 and through the 15th century. And so these Jews, who openly adopted Christianity, but of course kept quite a bit of Jewish practice, some recent articles about people in Central America who are still doing Jewish practices, the Murano phenomenon really is a phenomenon about how strong Judaism is. The Murano said, Esther is a terrific paradigm for us. She hid her faith to save her people. Of course, the Muranos don't have proof that Esther adopted the other religion, but again, their presumption was that she was living openly, not as a Jewess, privately as a Jewess. That's a Murano. So, Muranos min HaTanach min Ayin, perhaps Esther plays a role there. The other group that looks at Esther in this way, and these are all different, in 1987, Pope John Paul II beatified a woman named Edith Stein. It's interesting, that's something that I lived through. I wasn't even such a young man then, but I didn't realize what the significance was. Edith Stein was a Jewish woman who at one point started to think about Christianity, and she became a Carmelite nun, and she made contributions there, but she stressed that she never gave up her Jewishness. She always thought about her Jewishness, and both in her own writings and when the Pope beatified her, she and he talked about Esther. Again, this is some kind of a model. You can sort of be something else outwardly, Jewish inwardly, and again, they didn't bring textual proofs for this. They brought a sense of what Esther was. As I say, we don't have any Mefarshim who will say that, and in fact, our Mefarshim will say different things, but what I'm going to show you in a moment, we'll start with that at the bottom of the page, and then what I'll show you in a moment is that even as I don't think there's any evidence for Esther converting, there is interesting halachic discussion based on Esther's experiences, again, some difficult ones, that will provide some very interesting chomer hilchati, real halachic material for some of the Rishonim in terms of people who are coming back to Judaism. And we'll see. You'll say, but I thought you said Esther never left Judaism. She didn't. But there is a return of sorts, and we'll see the return that Esther practiced, and we'll see, and that will be most of our discussion, we'll see how that sort of filters in, al pi halacha, into some very interesting issues of Jews who come back. So let me, now that I've laid it out for you, big gadol, let's go a little bit piece by piece, and let's start at the bottom. Usually we start at the top, but we start at the bottom. Again, I want to commend everyone. It's Daylight Savings Morning. That's a wonderful thing that you're all here, Bisman, and Yashar Koach. You all woke up an hour earlier to come to shul, to daven, to study Torah, so you get wonderful, wonderful schar. Mirtz Hashem. Good. So at the very, very bottom, let me just show you two things, the Ibn Ezra piece on the left in a moment, the piece on the right, just a sense of where Esther as a Jewess was in Malchus Achashverosh, at least according to medieval rabbinic sources. This is a comment labeled the very wonderful Mosar Rav Kook edition of Megillas Esther with the Perushim. Chachmei Tzarfat, again, French, northern French Chachamim. This is a melange. This Perush is a mixture of Rashbam, Yosef Kara. So we don't know exactly who made this comment, but they're students of Rashi and so on. Certainly, we have to pay very close attention. And they write as follows, Lo higida Esther ki mordechai etamavet molata ki mordechai tziva alea asher lo tagid. Im yivadal malchut amal Moladta, simply put, why was she so secretive about her people and her birth, the nature of her religious birth? Afilu yachpotz hamelech lahamlicha. If her real identity would be revealed, even if the king was ready to appoint her as the queen, to anoint her, lo yanichu sarav avadav, his subjects wouldn't allow it. Shekol haumot sonim et Yisrael. Everybody hates the Jews. There's a Tom Lehrer line like that in a very nice parody. He means to get out of it, but in terms of nuclear proliferation, I don't know if anyone knows what we're talking about. It's a record from 1965. Somebody here knows, thank you. So, you know, my jokes are getting older as I am, so I have to make sure that somebody knows. But anyway, that's it. And therefore, again, these Mefarshim don't say, and therefore she accepted something else. But that's what's at stake here. In other words, religion is certainly at stake. But let's look at Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra looks at the secret behavior of Esther in a very interesting way. And I apologize for the small size. The trick is get as much stuff on a page as you can, because it's good stuff, much important stuff. And we have two nuschaot. Again, the Moser Rav Kook gives us two versions of the Ibn Ezra, both which say something very similar and something very important for us. And Ibn Ezra, in Perek Beis Pasuk Yud, is wondering about this secretness, the secretive nature. And if you look at the underlying underline v'hanachon beina, he goes through different possibilities. Of course, Chazal and Mefarshim have different understandings of why Mordechai instructed Esther to keep things secret, so it's not just Esther's idea. This is Mordechai's approach. Hanachon beinai, says Ibn Ezra, what seems to me to be the best approach, ki asaze Mordechai bavor shetishmor Torah Hashem b'seter. In fact, by not saying what religion she was, she'd be able to keep Judaism better privately. Again, the issue of Achashverosh is a thorny issue and has to be dealt with separately. What about everything else? Kashrus, Shabbos, right? What about all other things? Again, we would assume she had to pass. So again, it becomes a kind of a Murano existence. It becomes very difficult. The Ibn Ezra, who, as we know very well, is no stranger to controversy on these types of things, here says Esther kept it all. We also have a model within Tanakh itself, right? Daniel, what do you eat when you're in a foreign kingship, right? Can't eat the bagels even. Or can you? Again, is it a big problem? Hey, McKenness, they even cut it. It's wonderful. Anyway, right? It all shows up right on time. Anyway, or at least a minute before. In any case, right? But what do you eat when you're sitting with Achashverosh? Do you eat, you know, Daniel? Do you eat seeds? Do you eat nothing? Do you eat air? What do you eat? So says Ibn Ezra that by keeping her religion secret, Mordechai was in fact ensuring that she'd be able to keep Judaism privately, shelo tochal mevelot, she wouldn't have to eat non-kosher food, v'tishmor hashabbatot, v'lo yargishu hamishartim. Suggesting that if they knew she was Jewish, they'd be watching to see what Jewish things she does. If they don't know that she's Jewish, she does what she does, and until somebody will figure it out, you know, it might take them a little bit of time, and that will give her a little bit of comfort here. Now, as we know, by the way, it's important to note, in the Megillah itself, this statement about Esther not telling anyone is mentioned twice. Generally, the way most Mefarshim understand it, I think in context it's the only way to understand it, once when she was in Beit HaNashim, when she was in the prep area, right? And once again when she got to the palace of Achashverosh. So there are really two separate locations and contexts we have got to pull this off. And if you look at the next comment, the second version, here he says it in some ways even more strongly than Ibn Ezra, and this will even work in the Melech's house. He'll say, Mela, to get away with it in Beit HaNashim. You know, if a woman says, I don't want to eat this and that, she's a woman watching her diet. We should too. But she can get away with it. You get to the Beit HaMelech, you know, come on, you got to go to this and you got to go to that. Look what Ibn Ezra says. Again, at the very end, there's some discussion before. The im hi tagid shelo tochal pat bag HaMelech says, if Esther admitted she was Jewish, it wasn't Jewish with an exception. That would mean that she would have to eat the food. You know, I'm Jewish, but I have to participate as a Jew. And if, and the other way, and if she said, listen, I'm Jewish and I can't eat, terrible trouble. She'im hi tagid shelo tochal pat bag hamelech, and that goes back to Daniel, what Daniel wouldn't eat. Yachrichena, the king would force her. V'im haita gveret, this is very interesting. If, however, she's a gveret, meaning what?
First lady.
That's right. Once she's already the first lady, that's the style. She eats what she wants. She doesn't eat what she doesn't want. Nobody's going to criticize the queen. Nobody's going to ask any questions. So by keeping quiet, Esther got to set her priorities, right? Tuchala hastir atzma. She could hide herself very well. Again, the Ibn Ezra is presuming here a very high level of observance on Esther's part. As I say, the living with a Achashverosh is the problem that the Balei Halacha, the Gemara, and Rishonim deal with. But other than that, Shabbos, Kashrus, up and down the line, because she went with this hidden policy, so it's hiddenness, al-minat, in order to sort of have it work out. I must digress for a second with just a cute story. It's a Murano story, which those don't sound cute, but you have to, when you deal with these subjects, try to inject a little bit of humor. Before the Spanish Inquisition started in the late 15th century, as we know, there were a number of institutions in Spain that conducted their own in-house inquisitions. Not putatively. They wanted to know who their people were in case they had any problems. So there was apparently a record of a monastery, this is true, which conducted an in-house investigation of its people, and they found that there was a certain monk, a brother, who each year, it was recorded, around September time, around the fall, would get an allergy of some sort. And he would go to a doctor, happened to be a Jewish doctor, who would prescribe that for about a week or 10 days, he shouldn't live inside the house. You know, you had to live outside. That's how the allergy was going to be cured. So every year, around September, October, early fall, right, this fellow would sit in this house, and of course, if he's going to live outside, he can't live on the street. He built a little hut, you know, what my grandmother called a butki, you know, a little hut here, right? And he'd sit in a little hut for about a week to 10 days. You know, it's the old thing to sit in the audience, take it down in a week to 10 days. And that's how he would go. So just sort of this idea that people don't catch on all that quickly. It's interesting, Tosis in a couple of places asks, according to the opinion that Mordechai and Esther were indeed married, so why didn't Mordechai divorce Esther so that when she was living with Ahasuerus, whatever that is halachically, they're not married at that moment, and there's no isser to return one's wife. Machzer grushasa was only if she marries somebody in between, but if she was married to Mr. X, he then divorces her, and we shouldn't know from any of these things. He goes back to Mr. X, that's mutter. So why didn't Mordechai do it? Satosa says, because then people would have figured out a get has a kol. Right? Divorce, unfortunately, Bezdin and the procedures and the perception. Right? That would let on. Then everybody know, oh, she's Jewish. But in the meantime, it's so fascinating. According to this approach, Esther could, in this sense, pass, not by making some choices, I will eat this, I won't eat that, I'm not sure, but really by holding to her regimen as a geveret. Zizdor geveret. If you're a geveret, what you want to eat is what you eat, right? First lady orders arm toning. Everybody arm tones. First lady orders this. That's what they do. That's Jackie Kennedy. That's the way it goes. You know, Lahavdil on the Torah, but that's the way it goes. Okay. So according to this, Esther is not a Marano in the sense that she did not adopt the other religion. And indeed, you have to look very hard now the other way to see what practices she did do. As I say, the Achashverosh issue, l'chud, that's the big issue. And for that, Chazal have many approaches. But it seems that Esther was trying to do all of this in a most punctilious way. So now we go the other way. There's one thing, well, in light of her relationship with Achashverosh, there's a very interesting and apparent halachic observance, or at least quasi-halachic observance, that Esther practiced. And this comes to our conversion discussion. This has tremendous and interesting, I think, halachic implications for, as I said, Jews who are coming back to Judaism. Even though Esther herself didn't really go out, there's an interesting implication. In order to understand that, we need to know a Gemara in Maseches Megillah, and the Gemara is Daf Yud Gimel Amud Beis. And in order to get us into this story, I'm going to take you into a very unusual responsum. That's at the top of the right hand side, and we're going to go right down the right hand side through this responsum. The Gemara in Megillah Yud Gimel Amud Beis will come out. Esther's role will come out, and we'll be able to package this thing and put it all together. This text is a very unusual text. It was published from a Budleian manuscript in 1973 by a person who I was never privileged to meet, but somebody who works with manuscripts is somebody who works with manuscripts. You know, it's a very small field. When my wife wants to tell me I'm doing a good job, but she doesn't want me to get too swelled ahead. She says, you're doing very well in your field of six people. And I think last week there were seven, but anyway, next week could be five. Anyway, but it should be well. But so this is somebody I would have wanted to meet. A couple of us were on a plane at one point. Some graduate students were sort of, you know, gallows humor, but anyway, how many appointments would come up? You know, shalol iftach peh, but anyway, so we try not to fly together. No, in any case, it's not that bad. I hope. Anyway, this is a very interesting text. Ephraim Kupfer, he used his Yiddish name, published a Budleian manuscript, which has a lot of material from German Balei HaTosfos that really doesn't appear in our printed Tosfos at all, and indeed isn't reflected in a lot of our other literature. Even the Sefer Mordechai, for example, doesn't quote this cat. That's a very interesting and troubling case. And let's read it through, at least briefly, and you'll see where Esther fits in, and we'll sort of bring all this together. Case involved a woman, Yehudis, shenitma'ah bein hagoyim. Nitma'ah with an ayin, literally she was submerged. It means she converted. In other words, she lived with. Again, we're not going to say she converted to Christianity. She sunk into. She fell into a Christian life. The yalda begoyut, and she gave birth as a non, you know, as a seemingly non-Jewish person, the chazra b'tshuva im banei haktanim, and she then said, "I want to come back to the Jewish community." And now she has two small sons, who are Jewish too. her sons. The kodem shemalu tovlu. Before they had a bris, because again, not a society where everybody had a bris, they needed a bris now. This is a medieval context. Again, we're talking about some type of 12th or 13th century text, you'll see. Before they were circumcised, they were put in the mikveh. Now that's interesting. That's important. When somebody converts to Judaism, even though the order, if it's reversed, there are all kinds of shilas, the correct order is, right? If it's a woman, acceptance and go to the mikveh. If it's a man, right? Mila, acceptance, go to the mikveh, more acceptance, and so on. Here, the order is pointedly reversed. It's first the young boys were put in the mikveh, and then they were given a bris, which tells you that the tevila here, the immersion, was not conversionary. Al pi halacha, why? Because they're Jewish. So the question is, what's it for? It's not cleanliness, what's it for? Right? So the discussion goes on. Nira da'osam ketanim dino tinok shenishba levein ha'goyim. Interesting. Their status is tinok shenishba levein ha'goyim. They are young children who were captured by non-Jews. They were young children who lived in a non-Jewish, Jewish children who lived in a non-Jewish environment. And therefore they're 100% Jewish, but they now have to be extricated from that environment. And the case goes on to discuss, based on a, just read a little bit more with me, line 3, Ein tzrichim gimel tamidei chachomim b'tevi lasan. They don't need a bezdin, 3 tamidei chachomim. This is not a gerus when you put them in the mikveh, because they're Jewish. Any maisa gerus requires a bezdin. Vodech, must be done by day, for example. It's a bezdin, it's a maisa bezdin. This doesn't require a bezdin, tovli mafila balayla. They could go to the mikveh at night as long as they go. Mihu lechol hapachos tzrichim tevila. But they need that immersion. What's the source for it? So this text quotes a source in Avos Derabinos, and again, a fascinating source, right? A Chazal source. Masa beriva achas, Riva is a young woman. Shenishbeis, she was indeed held captive by non-Jews, and again, in those days, if you were held captive by non-Jews, you were living in a pagan, non-Jewish society where you certainly were living according to their rules. And the text discusses that two righteous men went to get her released. They got her released. One of the righteous men then wanted to marry her, and they said, not a problem, because she's Jewish, right? She's a Riva, she was a Jewish girl who got, again, taken away, but she got to go to the mikveh. And that was not Mishum Nidus. That was a tevila, again, as the text asks, Rivazu bima chashtua, what do you think she did wrong, so to speak, that she needs this tevila? Amrulo, kol osam yamim shahaisa shruya beinehem. She didn't do anything wrong. It's just that all the time she was living in this pagan, non-Jewish environment, haisa ocheles mishalahem v'shosa mishalahem. She was eating and drinking non-kosher food, right? In other words, you know, goyish food in the worst sense. V'achshav amar titbilua kadei shetitaher. The tevila is not a Nida Tevila. It's not a Gerus Tevila. What is it?
Tumatakum.
It's a purification Tevila. What's the Tuma? Tumatakum. Gvaria was responsible for bringing me here the first time. He's still giving the answers. He's terrific. Anyway, good. Terrific. No, no, he's got to put some in the audience with the answers. Anyway, have the Rav, but he's polite. Anyway, good. Rabbon. The, I pay a lot of money for these. Anyway, right? So, there's a kind of a tumah, a new tumah, called tumatakum, right? If you live in a non-Jewish milieu, I don't mean as we do, where we interact, but if you are being controlled in terms of what you eat and how you proceed, your physical existence is in a non-Jewish milieu, there's apparently a concept here of tevila, and it's in Avos Derabinasan, very important source. And it's now being, I was going to say resurrected, which is a bad word here, but it'll work, right? It's now being reimagined in this 13th century German source, as we'll see, and it's being applied. Okay, so that's what that's about, and that's the tevila that these young men and this woman needs. Before their bris, it's not a gerus, it's They were living amongst the Akum, Tinok, Shenishva, Ben Ha'akum. You need a Tevila. You need a Tahara process to come out of that existence, right? And as the text then continues, even though we say, Lefi Psak HaGeonim, I'm skipping a couple lines, Ha'omer Di Yisrael V'Chotehu, even though we have a rule, it's interesting, Rashi held this rule very, very strongly. They quoted here from the Geonim, I think I know why. Rashi held, it's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, but Rashi held very strongly in a number of his responsa, and we have it really mituad ad hasof, it's very fully documented, whether these were Jews who were affected by the First Crusade, or before that, or slightly after that. Rashi said, if a Jew wants to, once a Jew has gone over to the other side, afal pi shechata Yisrael hu, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew, at what point do they come back? At the point that they say, we want to come back. Rashi does not say explicitly, no Tevila, but Rashi seems to suggest nothing else must be done. And so this approach, which is suggesting Tevila is required, seems to be a different approach than Rashi, because Rashi's point was, ad kidei kach, not only did someone who had converted to Christianity formally, you know, publicly, were they considered a Jew, so that if they did a kiddushin and the woman accepted, no one knows why she would, the kiddushin goes through. If they gave a get to a prior Jewish wife, the get goes through. If there was a yibum question, the brother-in-law was a mishumad. According to Rashi, he had to do chalitza, right? If the Jewish brother, Jewish wife, now converted, forced converted brother-in-law, had to do chalitza. That's not so simple. Rashi said, absolutely. Why? It's not that I like the woman less, or I like chalitza more. It's that I like the Jew more. And this fellow, afa pi shechata Yisrael, who a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. It would seem, al pi halacha, it would seem that for Rashi, for example, this tevila would be extraneous. You need nothing. But there is an opinion growing here. You need something. And that's exactly what's being discussed here. So they quote the Geonim, afa pi shechata Yisrael, tovel beino levein atzmo. Nonetheless, throw them in the mikvah. Not perfunctorily, but in other words, they've got to go to the mikvah. Now we get some names. The Kosav Harav Rav Bonfant B'Shem Sar. And if you look at footnote 5, we know who these people are. Again, these are German Bali HaTosfos who appear in this text and in others, many others. Rav Bonfant is his nickname. He's Rav Shmuel Halevi of Worms. And his Rebbe Sar is Rav Simcha Mishpira. Simcha Mishpira is the biggest Bali HaTosfos that we don't know. He wrote a humongous sefer called Seder Olam, not the chronological Seder Olam that people know, a sefer halacha, which has been largely lost. This particular manuscript that Kupfer found publishes quite a number of pieces. Ze sefer gadol v'chashuv. And we know that Rav Simcha Mishpira was a teacher of several leading and important Bali HaTosfos. The Orzer Roy is one, this Rav Bonfant is another, and down the line. So Rav Simcha Mishpira says, I endorse this. Whether he wrote the whole tshuva or what, but he's endorsing it, and again he gives the reason. Kidei shetitaher min ha'aveira. Purification from sin. Not because you're not Jewish, but if you want to now come back and live a full Jewish life, you need a tahara. You need a purification. What is it?
Symbolic.
Oh, it's a symbolic act, right? So historians get all excited. Is that what you call an unbaptism? Ulai, but that's not how it's being couched in halachic terms, right? Popularly, you know, ha'pesha asar ha'pesha hitir. But here it's an act of, it really is a metaphysical, it's a symbolic, a religious act, right? And again, Rav Simcha Mishpira continues, it's not that the food is treif, and therefore it's tamei. Treif food is also to eat. Pure treif food is no less... Tahor than pure kosher food in terms of Tumah V'Tahara. It's not a law of Tumah V'Tahara in the absolute halachic sense. It's a metaphysical Tumah. It's a religious, it's a spiritual Tumah. Right? Now if you look at footnote 6, there is an interesting ramification here that does get applied to the larger community. The Minig Yisroels, the Ramah mentions, and others, men, Yomim Noroyim time, Gar the Mikveh, Gates of Mikveh. Why? Because we're all chotim, we all need tshuva, mikveh as tshuva. Right? Not the way the women do, mikveh as tshuva. And that radiates out from here, but this is the primary case. This is where Rav Simcha Mishpira enunciated it first, and his Talmud, the Orzer Roy, picks it up from him. So this is a very interesting concept. Again, one which I don't think that Rashi would endorse la halacha. It's a machlokas, it's not a problem. Rashi says not necessary. These Rishonim say, necessary. Here you're going to see the Esther connection coming, and it's going to be a biggie. Now, since this is, so is this a halacha? Is this a hashkofa? Is this an Eitzah Tova? The answer probably is yes. It's something somewhere in the middle, right? But again, Yesh lezeh samchut, it's got Makoros and Chazal. But now these Rishonim Kedarkam Bakodesh want to find other sources. Where do we have such a concept? So they go through a very difficult, I mean interesting, but difficult sugya in Psachim Daf Tzadi Beis about an Orel and Karban Pesach. You have it in the printed Tosis, you have it here. And if you want to know more about that, the Rosh Shiva Rabbi Willig will be here. He's talking Pesach. You can ask about that sugya. It's a good sugya, but we have no time now. But as you see, down to where I underlined it, Ktsas Yeshraya, here's Noharaya. Where do we know such a concept of Tevila as a metaphysical purification in this type of a situation? Ktsas Yeshraya min Esther. Oh, proof from Esther. What do you mean Esther? We just got finished saying she ate the right food, she was doing a, she's a gveret. Shahaisa Toveles Fahaisi Osheves Becheko Shamordecha. Again, the Gemara in Megillah that I had mentioned, very unusual Gemara. The Gemara says that when Esther lived with Ahasuerus, she was married to Mordechai, and it was proper. Again, that's what Tosfos asks, why didn't he divorce her to save her all these obligations? And that was a problem too. She lived with Mordechai as well, but in between she went to the mikveh.
How do we know that? The Megillah still doesn't happen.
Rega. I'm gonna have to take away his check. Anyway, no. Chas v'shalom. No, I'll answer. 100%. No mashma'ut in the Megillah itself. Yesh mashma'ut in Torah Shebal Peh. And my point is the Balei HaTosfos Dafka pick this up because the Nora Chashuv Lahem. In other words, this is something, this is where their reasoning al pi Torah Shebal Peh, right? The Gemara says it, Rav Huna straight, wait, and I'll show you the Tosfos in a second. And so let's just work it for a second. So Gvarial is quite right. It's not in the Megillah itself. But by the way, how did Esther deal with all of these challenges? Right, Ibn Ezra's claim is a great claim. Katuv Shamba Megillah. That's the problem with Megillah. Everything is Ne'alam. So we're trying to get traces and hints to try to figure this out. But again, she would go through a tevila. Why was she going through this tevila? So the text here explains. Va'osa tevila ha'isa mishum zuhamasa shel osa rasha. Zuhamah here doesn't mean filth or schmutz. Right, whether he showered Achashverosh well or not, I don't know. And that's not the point. Right, we'll see what Rashi says. Here, Zuama means a sheen, a film of tumah. It's metaphysical filth. It's tumah. Right? It's tumas akum. Right? And so in order to eliminate that, she would go to the mikveh. Exactly. Therefore, so Esther here becomes a paradigm, interestingly, for returning Baalei Tshuva, not, we call about the FFBs, the BTs and all that stuff, not somebody who grew up, not from, became somebody who literally had lived amongst the Goyim. Again, this is a phenomenon in this period, 12th and 13th century, amongst the Rishonim. It's not Ma'asim Shebachal Yom, but it's not uncommon. And therefore, they are looking for halachic justification and anchoring for this type of thing. Interesting, the text concludes, and we'll talk a minute more about it, Va'od smach mi Yerushalmi, we have a Gemara Yerushalmi that's a much bigger principle, but it has application. Kol ha'poresh mechol l'kodesh ta'un tefila. Whenever something goes from a profane realm or use to a holy use, you mark that with a tefila, right? Again, that may be part of what Nidus is about in a secondary way. That's certainly part of what Tevilas Hames is about, Rahman. That's certainly what many kinds of Tevilos are about, right? But again, whoever goes from a more profane realm to a holy realm, Ta'un Tevila, Umehai Tama Matzach Yushami Tevila Lechli Sheikhum Nagoy. Interesting, I don't know if you're aware of this, you might well be. Tevilas Kalim, when we immerse vessels that were produced by non-Jews, even if they were never used for any food, they could be 100% new off the line. If they're the proper material, we do tevilas kalim. Why? So Yerushalmi says poshut. There are other reasons. Yerushalmi says poshut. It's going from a non-holy realm to a holy Jewish home. Certainly, hope so. And therefore, that transition must be marked by a tevila. Now that's in the realm of, you know, domeim. That's in the realm of kalim. But there is an analog to the role, to the realm of medaber as well, right? In other words, from the lowest to the highest, this is a symbolic act. So it turns out that Esther plays a very interesting role in these medieval texts, and that was the second part of my title, right? Conversion, Jewish identity, history, and halacha. Esther plays a very significant role as a role model for these kinds of things. Just to show you, by the way, I just below this text listed for you Rashi and Tosfos on that Gemara. Rashi says v'tovelis. I'm sorry to have to excise everything and cut and paste, but that's how you do it. Rashi says tovelis machmas nikius. Shalotehei, there's a little lamed that got cut off. Shalotehei ma'usal at tzadik mishchivas shlachashverosh. Rashi is, you know, it's not nice to go from Achashverosh to Mordechai. It's a lo yafeh. Ich. Right? There's a certain ich factor. Is ich tuma? Is ich bigger? You know, we could darshan it too. But Rashi is not being quite as expansive here as what we saw in this text. Tosfos, interestingly, has a different point on the spot. V'im tomar v'ho lo hayasham havchona shlosha chadoshim. Again, Tosfos, we got a bigger problem. She's living with these two people. Again, al pi halacha, Esther karka olam haisa, and the Gemara discussed that so well. By the way, interestingly, we're always looking for paradigms here. If you think about it, and I'm not the first to suggest this, Rishon Macharon suggested, there is a model in the Torah itself for this kind of potential behavior. Imri no achosi at. And the suggestion is that Avraham knew that if necessary, Sarah, like Esther, these are really outstanding Jewish women, could be involved with these kings, not be involved at all, be there but not there, al pi halacha, and they could manage to move through. Nobody else can try that, but they could try that. So you have a very interesting issue here. And Tosatosa says, but wait a second, we have a different problem. We need to know, perhaps she became impregnated by Achashverosh. How do we worry about that? Tosa says, Haisa mishameshes b'moch. She used birth control. Very interesting. There it's mutter. She used birth control in order to make sure that, without any shyness, to make sure that Achashverosh was not on the scene in that regard. So it's a very sensitive usage. And now I want to sort of transition and say, we will find that this tevila, this immersion for a returning apostate, a Meshumet Achoz B'Tshuva, right, this text supports it. We will find it amongst other Rishonim too, right at this time. So this really was, I don't say it was a burning issue or a ubiquitous issue, but this was a real live issue, and so this piece from Esther becomes very important. If you look, actually, first look at the English for a second. This is quite an interesting collection of Myron McComas, if I do say so myself. You've got to make lines between the pages here. This is a piece, not from the Talmud Yerushalmi, but from Professor Yerushalmi, Olav HaShalom, Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, who I actually got to study with a little bit too, very great scholar, who died just recently, published an article in the Harvard Theological Review, that's what HTR is, in 1970. And as you see from the text, he uncovered a Latin document that he translated here from a confessor, a Christian confessor named Bernard Guy. Bernard Guy worked in Provence in the early 14th century, and as a Christian inquisitor, one of his jobs was to debrief a Jew who had converted to Christianity, which according to the Christians counts, and now try to go back to Judaism, which according to the Christians, you can't do. So when they would get a hold of those reverting Jews, they would interview them to try to put them on the right path. And Bernard writes that in meeting with these Jews, more than one told him, and some of them apparently came from Germany, some of them were in southern France, more than one of them told him that when we went back to Judaism, oy, did they give us a tevila, did they put us in the mikveh. If you read this text carefully, this is like the mikveh experience from Gehenna. They put them in the mikveh, bigadol. They rubbed them. This is men, thankfully, right? Their fingernails bled. They had the hair shaved off. Sand was rubbed. You know, Boris, they gave the borax, you know. They really rubbed them clean. Interestingly, by the way, it's not by accident. They rubbed them especially hard on the site of what's called the chrism. That's when you accept baptism, the parts where you're anointed to imitate what had happened earlier to Jesus. Here, they reversed. Now, Yerushalmi said, who knows Jewish texts, he said, I don't find this anywhere. Where do we find this? Certainly not in Rashi. And again, for those of you who know some of the literature, Professor Yaakov Katz, my doctor father, wrote extensively about this approach of Rashi, and he said that wins the day. Af pi shechati Yisrael, you need nothing. So Yerushalmi says, I didn't find it, Rashi. Katz suggests it's a popular custom, which is an interesting idea. In other words, the Rabbanim didn't require it. They sent the mikveh committee of the Balabatim, who were upgehitzed. Listen, they were very upset. Jewish people get very upset when somebody converts to Christianity. So what were they going to do? They were going to deconvert him, but good. So it's some kind of a popular, you know, overzealous, you know, drive. When I put here at the bottom, Ayin Baramo, Marshal, Bach, Shach, Va'od, Yerushalmi quotes all of them. If you look in early Achronim, such as Ramo, Marshal, Bach, Shach, and other Mefarshim Shulchan Aruch, you'll find such a tevila, but not in Rishonim. So Yerushalmi says, I guess it must have been a popular custom. Unbeknownst to Professors Katz and Yerushalmi, and that's just my mazel to fall on the manuscripts, you find this in quite a number of medieval Jewish texts of this period. The one that we saw from Esther is only one of the more exciting ones, but it appears this was a real issue. So when Yerushalmi says they threw him into the mikveh, that's correct, right? Rashi didn't require it. Machlokes! They were machmir. They went like these other Rishonim. Let me give you two examples of that, and we'll try to bring this all home. If you look, a responsum of Ri of Dompierre. Ri of Dompierre, those of you who learn, Ri HaBalatosis, Ri HaZokei, Rashi's great-grandson. This is from a very interesting manuscript, by the way, Vercelli, C235. Vercelli is a place in Italy that at one point had a very, not a large, but a very important Jewish community. It also was a very important location in terms of church diocese for a period of time. And this is the way these things happen. Philo Sefer Torah Shebaheichel needs mazel. They had a collection of Jewish books in... It's called a bishop's seminary. I don't know if it's a monastery or what it is exactly. I've not been there. One of the books that they had, one of the Kitvei Yad, was a Sefer Mordechai, which originates in the late 13th century in terms of when it was written, with all kinds of glosses on the sides, or as they call it in Israel, bachalonot. They're a vinkalach. Anytime there's a little place to write, somebody wrote in the middle some more stuff. They have some texts that nobody else has. They seem to be authentic. There are names on them. And these are pieces from the Rishonim. It's part of what I do with my time when I'm not sitting here in Philadelphia. Well, even when I'm sitting here, I do it. But you look at these texts and you try to figure out, what do they add? So here we have a text that's really part of a longer story. I just gave you the punchline. I'll give you the beginning of it. There was a Jew who had adopted Christianity. The Re dies in 1189, so the time context you have. And the Re, the fellow, now wanted to come. He came back. He's back. He's back in the community. In Troyes, where Rashi had lived. Two Jews go over to him and they say, are you really from? Do you mean it? You know, they gave him a shalom aleichem. Are you sure? Right? I'm, you know, paraphrasing a little bit my way, but that's okay. And the fellow was afraid of them, it says, right? They gave him the, you know, the Dutch uncle treatment, and he was nervous. So he hid himself, you know, he ran away, and he surfaces as a waiter or as a servant. And what is he doing as a waiter or a servant for Jews? Pouring Jewish wine like crazy. So they go to the Re and they say, and what's the rule? If somebody has gone out of the faith while he's still technically Jewish, pito paskusi, his bread is considered completely non-edible, his wine is considered yeno yenesech and so on, not drinkable by Jews, and now he's touching all this wine, right? What do we do with the wine? The Re says, not a problem, because he's come back. Sounds like Rashi. He's come back. In other words, he's back in shul. Also, in those days in Troyes, if you didn't go to the main shul, you know, there weren't three shuls. Your shul, my shul, the one that nobody goes to, right? There weren't those three shuls. There was one place to go. If they saw the fellow in shul, and he was again putting on tefillin, and he was moving his lips, and it looked good, right? They gave him an aliyah, and he said the bracha, and I'll say very bad humor, he didn't cross his fingers, right? He didn't keep his fingers crossed. Anyway, never mind. They said, You're in. But to re-add something, Aval Hai Meshumid, this is just my transcription, Yodeyahu. How do we believe him? You know, Hanistaras Lashem Elokeinu, we're going to lie detector test, how do we believe him? Yodeyahu, there's a kind of a non-proliferation pact, a verification pact here. Shekol Zman She'eino Tovel U'mekabel Olav Divrei Chachomim U'muchza Kegoy. That as long as he hasn't gone to the mikveh and accepted all the instructions of the Chachamim, we're going to treat him like a guy. En passant, just in passing, what is retelling us? All such people went to the mikveh. And the mikveh acted here not so much as a purification per se, but as a kind of a deterrent. He knows that we know that he knows that we know that he went to the mikveh. So he had to do a maisa. You can't just promise to be good. He did something. And he now appears to be listening to what the Chachamim say, right? He's not only doing, keeping Shabbos, but he's listening to what the Chachamim say. That's a full Jew. A Jew who says, I'll keep the Torah, but I won't listen to the Chachamim. Don't get nominated him for a full membership either. Right? Good. Lekach, and therefore the Reis says, Lo tzarech gimel lekabel lefneihem. He doesn't have to go to a Beis Din. You know, you'll say, take him to a Beis Din. Make him, you know, report publicly to a Beis Din. He says, no. The bekal yesh lanu ladas sheshavel boro kaven shenoe gatzmo kedos or bidos yehudis. We have an easy way to tell. How does he act? And did he go to the mikveh? And it's interesting, by the way. And how do we know he went to the mikveh? Because he says so. How do we know the woman goes to the mikveh when she's supposed to? Al pi halacha? Because she says so. All right, we have all kinds of formal and fancy things and all of that. Basically, al pi halacha, if that's your requirement, you do it, it works. You're believed. So this is the kind of combination here. But again, the Esther text of Simcha Mishpira is a little bit later than the Re. The Re already has this. He's disagreeing with his great-grandfather Rashi. Happens every day in Tosfos, right? There's a beautiful poem in Rabbeinu Tam Sefer HaYosher where somebody writes, Shimshon Mifalez writes, oh, wouldst Rashi, he's writing an ode to Rashi, Mi Gale Afare Necha, right? The Minig Yisrael, then a person is buried, they put the dirt on the eyelids and so on. Who, you know, it should be Rashi that you will come out Tchias HaMesim. And what will you see when you'll come out of the Kever? Vihine Ben Bincha, he says, you'll see your anicle coming to mow you down in Halacha, right? He's going to come shmeis you in Halacha, right? And that's Nachas, right? That's Nachas. So that's not a problem. It's disagreeing with Rashi is not a Kasha. To the contrary, it shows that we have some voltage here. We have some real interest in this Tevila. And one more. In this same manuscript, there's a Tosfos, which the Ritva, for those of you who are interested in these things, the Ritva and Yevamis quotes the need for a Tevila from a Tosfos Achronos, a late Tosfos, you know, the smoking gun Tosfos. Right? So for years the gun smoked and nobody answered. You know, you have to know where you put your head into. So I fell into this manuscript. I think this is a smoking gun Tosfos. The smoking gun Tosfos in the mid-13th century is trying again to find more halachic justification for this Tevila, and it's understandable. It's basically almost a kind of Takana de Rabbanan. So you want to have more Makoros. And this Tosfos plays, and I'll just summarize it for you because it's a complicated sugya, it plays in learning with a very interesting thing. We know that when an Eved Kenani, a so-called non-Jewish slave, right, a Canaanite slave, becomes an Eved Kenani, so he has Mila and Tevila. He undergoes a circumcision and an immersion. Mechuyav mitzvos now, Ki'isha, and so on, but for a different reason. He's not a full Jew. He gets that status. And he's really not supposed to be released. But let's say he's released. The moment that he gets a get shichur, the moment that he's fully released, he becomes a full Jew. He gets a full Kedush Yisrael. So the interesting question is that it? He gets the get shichur. It's a get. He gets a statement, a document of release, which is required. And then the question is anything else. So there is a view that he has to have another tevila, another immersion. In fact, the Rambam says this immersion is min haTorah. Most say it's not. It's an immersion to Rabbanan. So what's it about? So look what this text says. Eved, echad eved hamishuchar tzorech litbol. The eved who gets freed has to go to tevila. Tema amai zokok l'tevila shnia. What do we need this for? Kimishachrim also v'halo eno to'un lachzor l'hativ dam bris. We don't redo his bris, thankfully, right? In other words, we don't even do a little blood, right? In other words, he's a Jew. He became enough of a Jew going in. He doesn't need to redo his Jewishness. So what's this tevila about? V'yesh lomar, this is fascinating. Tehimi derabbanon. It's a takonah derabbanon. It's a din derabbanon. Kidei la'asos hekeira bein avdus l'cheirus. To make a distinction between servitude and chayrus, how so? The hachanami, we learn the same thing. Yisrael, afapi shechati Yisrael hu, vafilu hachi kisheshav sarech tevila. He's re-elevating himself or herself on this kind of a rabbinic level. If you look in the Nemuka Yosef, who quotes the Ritva from the smoking gun Tosfos, Mishum Ma'ala, he calls it towards the end. It's a Maila. A Maila here doesn't mean it's a nice thing, it's a Maila, you know, he's tall, it's a Maila. No, that's not it. Mishum Ma'ala means the person is being uplifted. They were in an impure spiritual state. Now they're in a different spiritual state. Right? That's true for Eved Kenani to a full Yisroel. There it's not a matter of purity, but it's a matter of elevation of Jewish status. Here it's a matter, it's not a conversion. It's elevation of status. Here it's a matter of Mala. So we've now got all over medieval Europe, both in northern France, right? Rue of Dompierre, 1189. This, by the way, is a Tosfot Evreux. That's the smoking gun Tosfot Evreux in Normandy. Very interesting place, very interesting base medrash, right? They're on board. Rav Simcha Mishpira is on board. The only one who specifically mentions Esther is Rav Simcha Mishpira. But we see that this is feeding in to a much larger phenomenon. Right? So this is a very interesting, I think, an unusual and unexpected kind of an outcome. Right? Esther is not a model for people who converted out. For sure not. Certainly not the way the Mefarshim learn it, right? We'll leave other interpreters and other traditions aside. Again, for the Maranos, you feel bad, but you understand how they use it, but you have to wonder. By the way, the same kind of thing happens when the Rambam's family is attacked by the Almohades. This is sort of the adumbration of the Maranos, right? This is sort of the earlier version, right? The fanatical Muslims come in, 1147, 1148, Berbers come in from North Africa, pronounce the Shahada fully, or we kill you. And people say the magic words and they leave them alone. The question is, and there are historians who claim they have proof, I don't think any of the proof to my mind is it yet begins to be at all compelling, that Rambam's family, the family of Maimon, knuckled under. What they did do is they hid out. Right? The good news then was everybody wore a turban, so you don't have to take your turban off. But you did try to pass. But again, there's a difference between passing while still observing privately and literally accepting, right? There's no evidence for Esther's acceptance, right? As there's no evidence for Mishpachas Maimon. Again, same kind of an issue, and I'm covering and cutting across historical periods here. But when it comes to Esther as a source for a returning Jew, here Esther contributes in a very interesting and unusual way. Again, as Baryal points out very, very well, there is no report of this in the Megillah, but the same Teresh Baal Peh that gets us through all of Esther from beginning to end in terms of observances, right? All of Tanis Esther, right? There's a Tanis in the Megillah. Is that exactly what we do? If you read it exactly, we should be fasting bullets in Chodesh Nisan. We don't do it. Again, doesn't mean to devalue it. Chas v'shalom. And there's a very interesting approaches, Rabbeinu Tam's approach, other approaches. That's what Rishonim do. But they mine Talmudic literature for these kinds of things. I will take questions now if there are any, and then I'll just end by telling you what the other shiur is and how it relates to this, and then I'll leave you with that. Please. Ladies and gentlemen. Yes. Good question. Daryavesh, right. There's a fellow who works on, a fellow actually from Teaneck where I live, who works on all of these things. Who's Ahasuerus? Who's Daryavesh? He thinks it's all somebody else. So in other words, again, doesn't say in the Megillah who had him either. So, never mind that, I won't say any bad jokes here, but, these things are not foolproof, but nonetheless, I mean, that was certainly her intent, yeah? So, just an interesting development, right? Again, by the way, the only question on Tosfos is, was she living this way with Mordechai and Ahasuerus the whole time, or only initially? There may have been a period when she was away from Mordechai. In other words, that's again, a very subtle question. Does this cover the entire period? Does it cover part of the period? And so on. So we leave that with a tzarachim. But yes, something else you wanted?
I did.
Go.
How do you know when that's
my understanding? Well, no. So, Chozer first of all, here, again.
Translate, please.
Yes, I'm sorry. Sure, you're absolutely right. How come today, when somebody returns, we don't do some of these things, or do we do some of these things? Where's the line in the sand? So, I'm not going to paskin before the Maradasra. That's part of my fun here. I get back on the train, and I leave him to clean up my mess, but he's very eminently qualified. And Baruch Hashem, you only come into places where they can clean up your mess. Anyway, now, in all seriousness, first of all, as far as being Balei Tshuva amongst the men, so, correctly, all the men folk go Erev Rosh Hashanah, Erev Yom Kippur. All of them go. Right? We don't say, you, twice. You, no. You know, the Merad Asra goes to everybody goes. Ein Tzadik Baruch Hashol Yachta. So this is not about being about tshuva in terms of I didn't keep mitzvah so well. This is about crossing the line of the Jewish community into another community. So that's the question today. Will, first of all, so Geirim obviously are required to go to Tevila as part of the Geirus. The question will be today, if you have people who are born Jews and have left Judaism and now want to properly come back, what must they do? And here, by the way, the early modern period and the modern period in Halacha has a different view than the medieval period. And Professor Katz wrote, although according to me, the medieval period was stricter too. But there are more things that might be expected of somebody coming back, right? In other words, Rashi was the biggest maker. And even though this is all Halacha, you know, our image of the Zeta Rashi was the nicest, was not only the biggest Rabban Shal Yisrael that we had, he's always the nicest person. He wanted those people to come back. He could do it. Not everybody could do it. Al pi halacha either, right? So that requires, the Rav can give the shiur, that requires, what do you, and there are, al pi, you know, again, it's, I managed to get to this late, but al pi halacha, al pi rishon nachron, what is required at what point? But to be very, very clear, it's not for averos. This is purification, min ha'akum. You know, it's bigger than just averos. All right, should we get one gentleman and one more lady? I want to go fair here. Yes, please, go fair and square. Go, sir. Yes, he seems to be, yes.
He was a Muslim, right?
Yes.
No, he wasn't.
Well, he's not a Muslim. He's
not a Christian.
He's certainly not a Muslim. No, he's certainly not a Christian. That's correct. You want to say Zoroastrianism? That might not be around. Well, that should be around already, yes? Right. So he is some type of Zoroastrian / pagan. Now, you're asking a good question. In Halacha, does the same thing apply to a Christian, to a Muslim, to a Zoroastrian / pagan? And the answer is yes and no. In other words, assumedly though, Achashverosh was some type of Oved Avodah Zarah. He was some type of an idolater. Now we get into the thorny question, which we want to talk about very gently. What is the issue of Christianity? What is the issue of Islam and idolatry? There may well be differences. The Rishonim here in Ashkenaz treated Christianity al pi halacha as Avodah Zarah. And so in that respect, there is even, it's very interesting because the Baalei HaTosfos did not necessarily look at every Christian individually as an Oved Avodah Zarah. You had to do certain things, but Christianity as a religion has that status. So in terms of going, you'll say, well, how can I bring a Raya from Esther? She's from Esther and Achashverosh, they're of the wrong persuasion. But again, the reason that Esther needed this Tevila was not because of Avodah Zarah, it was because of living with an Oved Avodah Zarah. Right? So again, that comparison to Christianity, I think, stands. Right? Like the case of the woman here. It's interesting, the case in Ovos de Rabbi Nosson, the Riva Achas. Don't know what religion she was. The Chachamim said, if you live, and so by the way, it may not make a difference here, Muslim, even if you'll assume that Islam is monotheistic. If you live with another religious community, meaning not you live in a city where they also live, you are living in their chasut, in their support. You're eating their food, not just because it's treif. When you come back to the Jewish community, when you come out of that community, this tevila might be applicable under any circumstance according to this approach.
But the Jews in that time were segregated into their own little place.
Different than today.
How is it possible that this king is going to recruit a queen from a Jewish area? He's going to send his agents into the Jewish area and say, oh,
so by the way, you're asking a very good question.
Without knowing that they're Jewish.
So by the way, that
completely unbelievable.
So by the way, now you know why the Megillah gives you the Megillah about the 127 people, right? Part of that, according to a number of Mefarshim, is that you didn't have a Jewish neighborhood. You didn't have 127 different neighborhoods, because having 127 different neighborhoods, that's a lot of grocery stores. You got to have, you know, some homogenization here. And that's exactly, I'm joking, but that's exactly where they make that point, that it's perhaps part of this was, and that's why that comment that we opened with, and everybody hates the Jews, somehow everybody else, the other 126, somehow managed to fit in. The Jews officially fit in, but somehow they stuck out. But again, I'm not sure they stuck out by neighborhood, because otherwise you'd be right. As you go in, you know, if it's Borough Park, you know, they could still be Italians, but they're probably Jewish, right? You know, it's that's the chance. So the answer is that there's not so much societal separation. Again, there are experts on this thing, but that's what I know as a non-expert is that's the stress that it's such a polyglot kind of a place. Yes? Please, ma'am. Yes.
Is it a common practice that people who
So there are within the Rishonim two approaches, and again, I'm gonna hate to say this, they're gonna consult their local Orthodox rabbi because that's a tough job for the other. There are procedures. Some do, some do. If you know somebody who didn't, it's okay too, but some do, right? And then big gadol, yeah. One or two other gentlemen had questions. I don't want to hold you too long. We'll go one gentleman, one lady. We're being very good here. Yeah, go ahead. Please.
The difference between Sarah and Esther.
Yeah.
Sarah went with the king, with the pharaoh, whatever it was. It was a one-time thing. Then she went back to Abraham. In the case of Esther, it was a back and forth thing.
So, by the way, right. So, very good. So, there are midrashim. Very good. First of all, the way it works out in Chumash, and Sarah got saved before it even happened. But that's, you know, like Hanani Mishal Vazaria. If you go expecting to be saved, don't do it. If you go expecting to do what you have to do, the fire is coming, HaKadosh Baruch Hu may save you. The model of Sarah, your point is well made, and again, what some suggest is that in Esther's case also, and that's what I mentioned before, the original, I'm just looking for some of the Makaras, the original intent was that it not be a long-term thing. In other words, that somehow it would be shorter term. So again, you sort of go step by step, right? And that's why she kept consulting with Mordechai. In fact, that according to one opinion, that's exactly what the going back and forth did. It meant she wasn't with Ahasuerus for a prolonged period of time. She was here and there and here and there, and talk of the Yeshua came. And so the difference is that in Sarah's case, the Yeshua came, you know, Hashem Parkar Sarah, before anything happened, right? In Esther's case, it required some participation, but again, relatively speaking, you know, it's the old story. On the one hand, the Megillah took place right over a year. You say, ooh, that's a lot of time to cover a 9 prakim or 10 prakim. Right, on the other hand, a little short one, on the other hand, that's Keheravayan. You know, it's a pretty short payout in terms of a larger story. But you're correct, that comparison has to be worked very, very carefully. Yes, please, ma'am. There was a question here amongst the women. Yes, please, you.
I was wondering if there's a historical reason that Rashi can afford to be more Mekiel.
So that's a very good question. Again, how much of it is Rashi? I mean, obviously these are issues of halacha, so we don't flip a coin, you know, this week I'm going to be Mekel, tomorrow I'm going to be Machmir, Chas v'Sholom. This was Rashi's Netiyah, and again, as I said, the interesting thing of this is, Rashi's Kula, his leniency with regard to these returning Jews, created some stringencies. Because if you were that wife of the dead husband Nebuch, whose brother-in-law was a meshumet, and he had to yet give you chalitza, which, you know, my hair would grow back faster than that, right? Chances. I'm very pleased. Last night on Shabbos, one of my grandsons said to me, Zadie, you have some hair up there. I said, thank you. Anyway, he inspected. He was getting nervous. So it's not all coolers. It's not all, you know, love and joy. In other words, it's a sheet in halacha. There are kulas and there are chumras. The question you're asking is a very important question, though. Historically, what Rashi's facing is that first crusade, clearly, where all of a sudden, and again, the numbers here are not knowable precisely, but they're knowable, you know, in terms of relative size, he comes face to face with not whole communities, but a bunch of Jews, even though many died al Kiddush Hashem, who did accept Christianity either under duress or willingly. And it could be that Rashi is again assuming al pi halacha that you will be able to, if you create a too big a log jam, right, if you make too big a line to get back in, it will not work so well, al-pi halacha. By the way, Rashi had a very interesting ally in this approach from an unlikely place, and you have to say, lahavdil. King Henry, the king of Germany, agreed with Rashi too. King Henry ruled in the early 12th century as a result of the First Crusade, land peace legislation. Jews who were converted forcibly at the time of the First Crusade can go back. So that's the only time we find Rashi having a chavrusa with the king of Germany. And again, lilo kesher. But again, Henry's shikulim were several fold. One, he hated the Pope. That's a side problem. But besides that, you know, ongoing problem. Again, you create havoc. If you're a king, you don't want a mess, right? So we can say lahavdil that sometimes in halacha you see a shas hakosher, you see that a policy will really give a communal result, right? To paskin halacha letovata community zemutar by gedolim, and so that could be part of the cheshbon. But you're right; there is a historical dimension here. All right, let me just, I'll take one or two more, but let me just tell you what's on the other side so we can almost come to a wrap up. What's on the other side, don't worry, I'm not doing it now. Even speaking quickly, we can't do it now. But now you will appreciate even more the issue of Afein Hoyu Ba'oso Hanes, which I'm sure some of you know the basic machloket. It's interesting here, and this has got no connection to the prior topic except a little bit of content. You have a machlokes rishonim, a famous machlokes rishonim. Women are obligated to hear the Megillah, to light Hanukkah candles, or to have someone light for them, and to drink the four cups of wine at the Seder. Says Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, three places in Shas, and they're listed here, Pesachim Kuf Ches Med Beis, Megillah Dal Amud Aleph, Shabbos Chof Gimel, Af Hein Hayu Ba'oso Hanes. They also were part of the miracle. And the key word is Af. They even were part of the miracle. Famous Machlokas, Rashi Rashbam on the one hand, women in these three cases played heroic, public, major roles. Esther, and we're now learning that Esther's private role was as impressive as her public role. Oh boy, was that hard work. Oh boy, Letovas Klal Yisrael. The righteous women of Egypt, all women get nodded, get marked heroines for preserving Jewish life at that time. And by the way, notice, in all these cases, Jewish life and family life was at stake. These are not issues of, you know, do I wear a bigger yarmulke or a smaller yarmulke? You know, a hat, not a hat, a shaitel, not a... There's a big, whoa, big, big, big. And Yehudis, again, who was not so well known, but who Rishonim draw out, Yehudis, at the time of the Hellenistic persecutions, also did what I call a Ya'el. She was able to avoid, right, the officer who raped all Jewish women before their marriage, which was part of these Hellenistic persecutions, just like the Beis Hamikdash. It wasn't enough to stop the Karbonis, you had to offer Chazer on the Mizbeach. So it wasn't enough to stop Jewish marriage, you had to defile it. So again, all of the realms here are interesting. Activist Jewish women who played a major role, and therefore, even though these three mitzvos are time-caused positive mitzvos, they're rabbinic, but the rabbis follow the Torah model, women should have been exempt, they're chayavos. Against that is the pshat of Tosfos in a few places, af hein hayu ba'oso hanes. They were also part of the miracle. The starring roles are all true, but that's not why you obligate women in mitzvahs. The reason you obligate them in these mitzvahs is because when Haman wanted to kill the Jewish people, he didn't say, I'll kill the men, the women will leave till later. Right? The same thing in Mitzrayim, and the same thing at the time of the Hellenistic persecutions at Hanukkah. Right? Women were involved in the persecution, they must be involved in the commemoration. What you'll find here, if you look, and I think I put my email on here, although I'll give it to you. It's not hard. It's kanerfog@yu.edu. What you'll find here is a third sheet in Rishonim, a sheet which distinguishes between different types of salvations. And it makes the simple point, but the important point. There's a difference between Jews eating man in the Midbar. That was a tense situation. That was fraught with danger. There were nachashim, srafim, vakravim, all kinds of terrible creatures, and cold and hot and horrible. There's a difference between going after HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Midbar and going after Haman and Hanukkah and fleeing the Egyptians. When the enemy is from without, that's when we have Pirsumei Nisa. That's when we have a chiyuv for everyone to participate. That's when we are saved in this type of a national way. When it's between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's also a Yeshua. But that's the difference. It's a Yeshua's Hashem, it's not a Nitzachon. Right? When we're dealing with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there are challenges that God gives us all the time that are between us and Him. Even if they involve other people. It's an inside job. It's an internal kind of a request. There may be an important distinction between those two types of salvations. So that's the shear that I didn't give. One or two more questions, I'll let you go. You've been terrific. Please. Did they struggle? Yes. did they have approaches? Yes. You'll invite me again. We'll go through them. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, you've been terrific. Thank you, Mara Dasra. Thank you. Afreilichem Purim, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you again to Rabbi Kanerfogel. Thank you also to Rebecca and Sheldon Goldberg for bringing the food and to the Center for Jewish Future of Support. We're going to bench, if anybody didn't bench yet. Dr. Stein, would you like to lead us? David Stein, you want to lead us in benching? Benching? Anybody didn't bench, want to lead us in benching?